Also, I think the responsibility I had just hit me, and I felt like I had failed her in some way because she wasn't going to survive much longer. The next day after work, I arrived at the hospital, and my brother Matt was in the waiting room outside the ward. I went to go in, and he told me that we weren't allowed. I walked in, but I was ushered back out by my uncle, my auntie's husband. He told me that Nana was in a bad way, and it wasn't good that I should be seeing her like that. I remember feeling so angry, beyond angry. I wanted to scream, "Listen, you, I've been here every day and night doing this shit for months. I've seen her at her fucking worst and I've been washing her piss-ridden clothes that no one else has cared about, most of which I have with me now clean, and I need to get her changed and give her some fresh Ribena in this week's magazine." But I didn't. I accepted that her children had now arrived to care for her. I sat in the waiting room and I waited to be called through by them. When I went in, I realised that my uncle was right. My Nana was dying. She was in her final stages, and it was a sight I could never have prepared myself for, and one I can still picture to this day. I was broken. So were her daughters, and so were my siblings and my cousin Sam. I imagine Mum got that call from me and thought I was being my usual dramatic self, but she and her sisters had driven down anyway, and I don't think any of them were prepared for the sight that had met them. Their beautiful mama, in the final stages of lung cancer, having kept it a secret from everyone because she didn't want to upset or bother us. It was my first experience of good lies, when someone keeps something from you or lies to you because they haven't got the heart to break yours. I went in and sat at my Nana's bedside for hours. As I got up to leave with all of my family behind me, I leant forward and kissed her forehead. Her skin was still as soft and silky as ever, and as I said goodbye, she reached for the Ribena and pointed to her lips. I gave her a drink, and then she kept signalling for me to leave the Ribena closer to her so she could reach it, because she thought she was being left on her own. My sister began to cry and said, "She thinks that no one is here. She thinks she's by herself. She thinks we're all leaving her." I tried to explain that Mum was there, but she was in and out of consciousness and had no idea what was happening. That image still haunts me, and as I say this, I struggle not to cry, because cancer really is one of the worst ways to die, no matter what your age. My mum and her sisters sat round her bed all night. The following morning, they left to go and get breakfast quickly, and when they got to the canteen, my Nana passed away. They say you choose when to go, and I honestly believe that. My Nana didn't want any of us to suffer at her suffering, ever. My Nana is the only person I've loved, properly loved, that I have lost to death. I suppose given the fact that I am now 36 and I have met and loved so many people, you could say that I'm quite lucky. But on that day, the 8th of April 2000, I felt like the unluckiest girl in the world to lose someone that I'd loved so much. After she died and my heart was shattered some more, I was about to hit self-destruct all over again. Looking back, I can see that the pressures in my life were building. However, when you're young and you're trying to break free, it's hard to recognise the signs of things getting too much. If I could speak to my 16-year-old self, I would tell her, "I'm proud of you. Hold on to your independence and your ability to look after yourself. Hold on to the sense of care and the love that you have for the people that have cared for you. And remember to take care of yourself. You're going to need it." Chapter 4. Toxic Times. So, that was going on behind the scenes of my new independent life. Nothing is ever simple, right? I stayed in dental nursing for 18 months. I enjoyed the job, I adored the dentist that I work for and I love my patients, but I simply could not live off the wage any longer. My rent was now £60 a week and I was still working almost 80 hours between two jobs just to pay bills, bus fares and food. I couldn't afford to buy clothes or shoes, I couldn't learn to drive. The reality of being an independent teenager was smacking me straight in the face, so I began to look for better paid jobs. Quite quickly, I found a new job in 2002, a care support worker for adults with autism and Asperger's syndrome who was sectioned under the Mental Health Act. The pay, to me, was amazing, and rather than clear £600 a month working 77 hours a week, I was now getting £1,400 a month for working just under 40 hours a week. Luckily, I loved the job too. It was challenging, but it was fun. I really liked caring for others and knowing that I was helping to give them a better life. The staff team was diverse, with older nurses and younger carers, but it worked well and we got on like one big family. I felt like I belonged there. Through earning more money than I was used to, I was able to buy nice clothes and to start having nights out again. But with that came alcohol and drugs once more. By now, cocaine had hit the nightclubs and it was so easy to get hold of. Anyone who was anyone was doing it. My week soon consisted of going out clubbing Thursday, Friday and Saturday and Sunday nights, then spending Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday recovering with a come down and a hangover. Looking back at that situation now, it really devastates me because I was so lost, and the thought of one of my girls ending up like that makes me feel physically sick. But I suppose that's what makes us the parents we are because of the life experiences we endure. My amazing wages were disappearing fast and my amazing relationship with Martin was going to shit. I treated Martin really badly towards the end of our time together. I was 19, still young but definitely old enough to know better. He had cared for me for 3 whole years, he had been nothing but a gentleman and showed me how my life could have been, but I just kept on fucking it up. I was trapped in a cycle of destructive behaviour and I couldn't get out. He begged me not to take drugs and I'd be on the phone to him promising that I wouldn't while I was going out to meet another dealer. I would ignore his calls at 2 a.m. where he would be sat outside the nightclub in his car waiting to pick me up because I knew it would be the end of us if he saw my drug-fueled state. However, it was never enough to stop me. It's difficult to explain now why I kept doing what I was doing, but there eventually came a time when Martin just couldn't do it anymore. And because of the hurt I felt at my own behaviour, I just kept getting worse. I flirted with other guys in clubs, and I trampled on Martin's heart even more when I knew I'd already broken it. I remember my heart breaking a little bit too. I was broken that I could be so horrible to somebody who had done nothing but love me through some of the most difficult years of my life. I begged him to take me back, and I promised that I would change, but he knew I wouldn't, and deep down, so did I. Shortly after we split up, he left the area and moved back to London, and I had no choice but to try and heal without him. Now, it's clear that I needed to make some changes to my life when Martin left, only it wasn't so clear to me back then. I moved into a flat share with my friend Stacy because I couldn't bear my own company and I was drowning in loneliness. Through therapy, I have come to realise that this is due to the fear and devastation of abandonment from my childhood. And although, back then, I gave Martin no choice but to abandon me, when he did, I just stopped coping. I thought a change of scene in a new flat with my best friend, rather than a change within myself, would help. I've now learned that while it might feel like you just want to run away, you never really start to feel better until you confront the difficult things and understand yourself. Stacy had grown up travelling all over the country with her mum Elaine. Elaine was amazing to me from the minute I met her. She never judged. She could see all my faults, but she just loved me and welcomed me because she had made many mistakes in life too. I really loved her in return. Stacy and Elaine had a role reversal relationship whereby Stacy was a sensible hard worker and Elaine just wanted to party and have fun, even though she was the mother, but it worked and they idolised each other. Stacy and I lived in a flat above a garage, rented to us by my sister's husband. The flat was bare, and as much as we wanted to make it a home, we just never had the funds or the time to do much to it. So we lived in each other's bedrooms and pretended that the lounge, the kitchen and the bathroom didn't exist. We would eat beans on toast or pasta and cheese most nights and watch TV together in her bed. I remember always feeling safe with Stacy. She was like my big sister, always looking out for me as no one messed with her. Not in a bad way, like she was a frightening person, but because she was one of the kindest, most selfless souls I have ever come across. I suppose growing up like she did made her have no fear about taking any shit or standing up to anyone. I liked this feeling of being protected, but I hadn't yet worked out any of my own problems properly. I was still reeling from my broken relationship, and I was still going out a lot. I was a regular at a local pub managed by a real womaniser called Tony. He was almost 10 years older than me, but always showed an interest, offering to take me and Stacy home after we'd been out for the evening. So many people warned me not to get involved, especially Stacy, and I always promised I wouldn't. He was old, or he seemed old, to the teenage me. He was a cheat and he had 3 young children. His relationship with the mother of his daughters was very much on and off, and everyone knew that she led a dog's life because of him. He made it no secret that he cheated on her. Tony started coming round at night after we finished work, bringing us food from the garage and watching TV and chilling with us. But then he began buying me gifts. They were the sort of gifts I could never buy myself because of the price. And within 2 weeks of the present starting, he had ended his relationship for good, he claimed. He then arrived at my door with all of his belongings. It all happened so fast and I didn't know how to handle it. I felt a tug of war going on around me. Stacey told me that if he was moving in, she was moving out, and I remember feeling suffocated from the very start. This wasn't what I'd wanted. I needed my girlfriends around me to help me heal from Martin. I didn't want or need a relationship, especially a complicated one where children and ex-girlfriends were involved, but he was relentless. It was as if he had decided on a campaign to get me no matter what I said. I would arrive home from work every day and continue to be showered with expensive gifts. On top of that, he began telling me he loved me. He would leave me voicemails on my phone where he was playing love songs down the phone, and I almost felt owned. Looking back, the only way I can describe it is it was as if I had been bought and I now belonged to him. I didn't have the strength to distance myself back then. It's so difficult when someone bears down on your space, your emotions and your time. You can quickly become overwhelmed. It gets even worse when that person is volatile. And also, when you haven't been raised around positive love, it's so easy to mistake the negative as good. One weekend, 3 weeks after Tony had moved in, I knew that Martin was down from London, as one of our friends had told me. So I went out to the local nightclub to try and see him. He ignored me for most of the night, but we still had so many mutual friends, we all left the club at the same time. He was walking ahead of me with Stacey and some others when Tony pulled up and got out of a car that didn't belong to him. He later told me that he'd borrowed it in the hope of following me to catch me out without me recognising him. He mounted the pavement, then jumped out and ran towards Martin, instantly headbutting him. I saw Martin knocked unconscious and lying on the pavement. He didn't even see it coming in order to be able to defend himself. Tony was going crazy, screaming and shouting and foaming at the mouth. He looked deranged, and the group of us, about 15 in total, just looked on in utter shock and disbelief. Tony then dragged me into his car in front of everyone. I can honestly say that I have never, ever felt fear like it. I actually urinated myself as he was driving while he was screaming that we were going to go to Berry Head to kill ourselves together off the cliff edge. As we sped through town, I just wanted to die there and then. I didn't want to die with him, though. So I opened the car door as he was driving, and I jumped out into the road. I remember bouncing like a ball down the road until I was knocked unconscious. When I came round, I was on the pavement next to Tony's car. I was informed by the ambulance driver he had been arrested at the scene, and he was now in custody. He told me his car would be towed away. I looked like I had been in a car crash and I felt like death. Amazingly, I had no broken bones. I was told I was lucky as I had jumped out at a taxi rank where the cars were slow moving or I could have died. The realisation of the type of relationship I was in had hit me and I felt so, so frightened. I called Stacey, who was at her mum's with Martin, so I got a taxi there. I walked in and I couldn't believe the state Martin was in. He had two huge black eyes, and my feeling of self-hate for what he had endured because of me came flooding back. He had barely even looked at me all night, and he still ended up black and blue. I had a shower and put some of Stacey's clothes on. Then we sat with Martin and Elaine in the lounge talking about everything. It was like a debriefing after a trauma incident. I felt so physically sick that my tummy hurt, and I had a lump of sadness in my throat for what I'd caused. Martin stayed with me that night and cuddled me to sleep. If I'm being honest, I would have cut my own arm off at that point for him to have taken me back. I missed him like I had once missed my mum and my nana, but I knew that I had caused too much damage, and even getting on my knees and begging him wouldn't have worked. The next morning he left for London, as he was running a successful business by now. He had moved on and he was coping without me. I remember his words before he left. "Always remember your worth," he told me. "Don't ever just settle, Rach." Those words have always stuck by me, mainly because I forgot them so many times over the years. But also because I know that I hurt him, and yet he was one of the good guys, and we shouldn't ever hurt the good guys. This part of my life was such a whirlwind. It would be a while before all these events sank in, but I've now learned a lot from them, and I can see how I wasn't in a good place. When you're in the middle of lots of drama, it's difficult to pinpoint the exact things that are making you behave in a certain way. People under stress and going through difficult times can act irrationally, and I understand that now, although I didn't analyse much at the time. When I look back, I can see everything more clearly, and I often think about how it's all impacted on me in later life. From now on, I'd also like Martin's words in neon lights in front of every woman in the land as she goes about life, "Always remember your worth." We should never, ever forget that. Try not to break a good guy's heart, because if you truly are a decent person, your heart in turn will break for the damage that you cause. Be honest if you don't love them, or, if it isn't right, end it, but don't stay because they're too nice to let go of, then end up destroying things far more. Sometimes, no matter how nice or loving someone is, they're just not meant for you. Being bought gifts is nice at times, but remember, being bought a bunch of cheap roses by a lovely guy at the start of a relationship is by far a better feeling than being bought an expensive watch at the start of an abusive relationship. No matter how nice lavish gifts are, always watch out for the warning signs. Domestic abusers work hard. It's draining to keep a victim under control. Abusers plan, they think ahead, and they're clever people despite society portraying them so very differently. Abusing someone to the point that they will stay in a relationship with you takes a lot of time and effort. Remember this, look out for it, and educate your children, because domestic violence within teenage relationships is devastatingly apparent. Chapter 5. A Brave Face and a New Baby. After Martin left, I went back to the flat and got into bed, just wanting to hide from the world. But later that day, Stacey answered the doorbell and in walked Tony's 6-year-old daughter. Even though it was still early days into our relationship, I had spent a lot of time with his daughters. I liked spending time with them. Now his eldest was at the door, and she said she wanted to tell me that she was sorry for what her daddy had done and gave me a huge bouquet of flowers and a card from M&S, a card I have kept to this day, written by her and signed on behalf of her two younger siblings. I felt her visit was a warning to me from her mum, Tony's ex, and this is what life would become if I stayed. But I already knew that I had made my choice to be with Tony. I made sure I wasn't in the house when Stacey moved out shortly after the incident with Martin, as I knew what I was doing shouldn't be happening, and I couldn't face her. It wasn't what we had planned less than a year earlier, and I knew that I'd massively let her down. I didn't see her much after she left, but then I didn't see any of my friends anymore. They couldn't understand my choice to be with Tony, and it was easier for me to hide myself away from them all. I continued to work hard, and I became a stepmummy to Tony's daughters, aged 6, 2, and 1. They were gorgeous children, and when I was with them, they helped heal all my broken bits. Tony's ex-partner was left shattered by their split, and trying to cope as a young mum on her own to such tiny children with minimal support was really hard for her. It also helps me to understand how so many women who have got out of an abusive relationship are still very much victims because the control never goes away. It's there, just as much, if not worse, through the children, financial, or in whatever way the perpetrator can still find to be controlling. And this is the life the woman still leads, despite being apart from him. Once you've let someone in, it's hard to flush them out. The girls were really the first children that I'd ever been round as an adult. I learned quickly how to change nappies, make bottles, and read them stories as they drifted off to sleep. I was thrown into it all very quickly, but I also loved them very quickly too. Tony continued to run pubs, so he was only home between 3 o'clock in the afternoon and 8 o'clock each evening. He worked long hours at the weekends, and the only company I had was the girls and my work colleagues. I need to jump forward a bit here, so can you bear with me, because this part matters. Since I began part-time working mummy, I have learned about the cycle of domestic abuse. This cycle is real, it's there, but it's hard to see when you're in it, and this is what happened to me, right from the very start. The highs were amazing. We went on trips away, holidays, nights out. I was lavished with gifts, and I felt loved and protected. He was an amazing father, so I had the family that I'd always dreamed of, and I could pretend that all the bad stuff was over, until it started again, and it always did. The lows were horrific. The violence was present right from the very start, but over and above everything, it was the fear of being trapped. There are certainly incidents that have never left me. Certain times that I screamed at his eldest daughter to call the police while he screamed at her not to, and she stood there, a rabbit in headlights, in total fear of who to listen to. It was devastating, and it leaves me to this day filled with a feeling of guilt that makes me feel sick. One night there was an incident which was so bad people outside our flat heard. Suddenly, I heard a banging on the door, and hoping that I'd be saved, I began screaming as loud and as hard as I could for help. Tony immediately left, and I guess headed for his car. Minutes later, my work colleague walked in and came up the stairs. He was friends with my neighbour, who had called him upon hearing my screams. I still remember his face when he saw me. There I was, fully clothed, sat in a bath of freezing water while my flat was trashed. He ordered me to get washed and dressed as he was driving me to the police station. I was seen immediately, as I had visible injuries. I remember the officer who spoke to me. He was young, with dark hair, and he was really nice, and he went out of his way to reassure me that if I gave a statement, Tony would be arrested. That terrified me. I thought of the girls, of the times that he was nice, and I just couldn't bring myself to do it to him. It all seemed far too serious. I left the station. I went home to grab some clothes, and my colleague drove me to a Birmingham service station where my mum collected me and took me back to her flat in a sleepy little town in Lincolnshire. I wasn't having much contact with my mum around this time, but I would speak to her throughout the month, and the contact we had was good and positive. I think the difference in what my mum saw of me since we'd seen each other 6 months earlier shocked her. My weight loss was horrendous. I was now skin and bone. My pelvic bone stuck out so much that it felt sharp, and my whole face was covered in spots, and I lived with constant mouth ulcers that made it even more difficult to eat. But more than that, I was no longer me. I'd been replaced with someone that I no longer recognised, but the appalling truth was, I was also someone who desperately missed the person who had turned me into this, and that is the reality of abuse. And so, the following day, Tony arrived after making the 8-hour drive to Lincolnshire with a huge bouquet of roses and drove me back home. Mum took me to one side and warned me that Tony was bad news, but she knew that I'd made my mind up, so she kissed me goodbye, and as I left she was crying, and she whispered in my ear to stay safe. I hoped that, by leaving him and our home, I had shown him that I wouldn't allow things to continue the way they were and that things would get better. When you think of someone who is subjected to domestic abuse, you see them as a victim. You see that they are always the one to get hurt and upset, but the truth is, at times, in my relationship, I was just as bad, and I believe that that's what kept me there. I look back at the venom that I spat, or the fights where I tore flesh. I bit, kicked, punched, hit, and it makes me feel sick that I could have ever have behaved like that towards another human being. When you are in a relationship so toxic, where you are so controlled and so conditioned, sometimes you don't know how to react. There were moments when I got so angry at my situation I wanted to make him angry too so that he would lose his temper, because once he had, we fought so badly that he would feel as bad as I did. It could turn into some kind of gang war, where we wouldn't stop until we were exhausted, having kicked shit out of each other and said things that couldn't ever be taken back. There were days when I hated myself so much for getting into this situation that I would purposely wind him up because I didn't want him to be sat there thinking things were okay whilst he was watching TV and I was running round after everyone yet again. I was genuinely exhausted. I was working full time, doing everything at home and looking after all the girls, whilst he would just sit in front of the TV, ignoring us all, and at times it would send me mad. I would purposely annoy him to the point he would lose it, sometimes with violence, but sometimes he would do things back to make me turn just as crazy. He would wait until I was asleep and then he'd put the bedroom light on and turn the TV up full blast. He would open the bedroom window in winter when it was freezing. He would wait until I'd put the shampoo on my hair in the shower and then he'd pull the electric cord to cut off the hot water. I would come out fumbling to pull the cord, wait for the shower to heat back up, and as soon as I got back in, he would pull the cord again. These sorts of behaviours were constant, they were repetitive, and sometimes I felt like I was losing my mind, and at times I would. Sometimes I got so angry that I would self-harm in front of him. I'd rip chunks of my own hair out or punch myself repeatedly in the head while screaming that I didn't know how to cope with the anger. So I stayed. And plenty of women do. You stay because you start believing that it is your fault, that in some sick, twisted way you must enjoy a fucked up relationship like this. And when you are told that you are as much to blame as he is, that you are totally to blame, you start to believe it. There is a horrible predictability to what happened for so much of it, but it won't surprise anyone that the next stage of the relationship was when I became pregnant the following year. While I have never doubted my love for my firstborn baby Betsy for 1 second, it did come as a huge shock. I was so thin and so unwell that my periods were never regular, if they came at all, and I certainly wouldn't have been able to keep any contraceptive pill down because I was constantly sick after panic attacks or anxiety. I remember secretly doing the pregnancy test in the bathroom of our new house that we'd moved into. Not for 1 minute did I think it would be positive, and when those 2 blue lines appeared, I was violently sick with shock. I continued being sick whilst muttering fuck over and over again. I sat on the bathroom floor leaning against the bath panel in total disbelief, and I called my brother Matt. I laugh at that now. Out of all the people I could have called, I chose him. I don't know why, because at this point in my life we rarely saw each other. He lived away in Bristol, and contact between us was rare. But I think I called him because I knew he wouldn't judge. He wouldn't be negative or nasty, and he wouldn't be disappointed in me. He would just take it all for what it was. I knew out of anyone, anywhere, he would make me feel better about what was feeling like the worst situation in my entire life. I was right. He just pointed out the harsh, stark facts about how things would become if I chose to keep the baby. I discussed all of my options through big fat sobs, and I felt devastated that I'd allowed this to happen. My parting words to him were, "I'm going to have a termination, Matt, and I'm not going to tell Tony." I sat there for a few moments, knowing the enormity of my decision, but also feeling that I couldn't bring an innocent child into this. I would love a baby, I had no doubt about that. But I could see the effects the situation was having on Tony's girls, and I just couldn't let another child go through it. It would be a huge thing to keep this secret and to end the pregnancy, but I had to be strong. I put the phone down and prepared to follow through on what I had decided. I opened the bathroom door and he was there. Tony was stood there. He was in the hallway and he'd been listening to the entire phone call. The argument we had was horrific, and it ended with me being told that I'd be keeping this baby no matter what I fucking thought. I had been irresponsible enough to get pregnant, and there was no way in this world that I was allowed to do anything else, he told me. No one was murdering his baby. I spent the first few months of my pregnancy in total denial. If I'd have informed my work I was pregnant, I would have been taken off duty due to the challenging behaviour that our service users displayed. So this was my excuse to keep it secret from everyone, when actually I just couldn't bear to face everyone's disappointment and the reality of the situation. My baby was due at the end of August 2004, and that summer was incredibly hot. We moved house again during my pregnancy, and now lived above one of the pubs that Tony was running. It was a beautiful flat, but it was in the middle of town with no outside space. Our bedroom sat over the DJ box and the noise was horrendous. I don't think I slept more than 3 hours a night for the last month of my pregnancy. I remember one afternoon a week before I was due, I was getting so hot that my body was swelling more and more by the hour. My toes and fingers were huge and I was sweating so much that I was dizzy. I walked down to my GP and I saw my midwife, who ran some tests and informed me that I had preeclampsia. I was rushed to Torbay Hospital accompanied by Layla. Remember her? Her wonderful mum Sammy, my sister, and Tony. Back then, there were no restrictions on the number of people you could take into the labour ward with you, and they were allowed to stay with me throughout. My labour lasted 28 hours. I was in and out of sleep, I had every drug going, and I was absolutely exhausted. The nurses put yoga mats on the floor so my friends and family could sleep and rest, but I was in agony. I tried to keep going, but in the end I had to have an epidural as I was really struggling to cope and I was really worn out. My baby girl arrived at 4:43 in the morning, weighing 7 pounds and 7 ounces. She had a mass of black hair and immediately latched on to feed from me like a little piglet. I named her Betsy. I have heard so many women say that they didn't get that sudden rush of love, that they felt nothing when they saw their babies. And while every pregnancy and birth book in the land reassures us that this feeling is normal, for me it was the opposite. I knew instantly. It was the first time I had ever been in love, properly in love. The second I laid my eyes on her tiny body covered in blood and gunge, her little eyes struggling to open and her tiny white fingers wrapped round mine, I knew that I would die and kill for her without question. And I promised her, as a whisper into her tiny perfect ear, that I would never, ever let her down. My Betsy. My friends that had children had warned me in every gory detail about labour and the aftermath. I'm one of those weird people who needs to know it all, no matter how bad or scary it is. I'd wanted to hear everything. The drugs, the pain, the afterbirth, the stitches, what pissing for the first time felt like, the lot. And I don't believe they held back in telling me, but I still wasn't prepared. About 9 o'clock in the morning after Betsy had arrived, I was in immense pain down below. I kept lifting my nightie up for a look, and there was what looked like a blood-coloured tennis ball sat in between my legs. It was throbbing and I couldn't work out why none of them hadn't warned me about this part of the process. I kept mentioning it to the care assistants and they reassured me that it was all part of the joys of afterbirth. The pain continued to worsen and the tennis ball turned into the size of a small melon. I started losing consciousness and another mum on the ward noticed that the blood was all over my bedsheets, so she shouted for the nurses. Within what felt like seconds, my bed was surrounded by doctors and nurses. I was in and out of sleep whilst hearing them talk about emergency surgery, blood transfusions, and trying to locate a next of kin to sign some form. I don't remember feeling scared at this point. I don't remember even thinking of Betsy lying next to me in our plastic cot. I just remember feeling like I needed to sleep and I couldn't physically stay awake for a moment longer. I woke up hours later to be told that I'd had a vulval hematoma. I had been taken to theatre where doctors had performed emergency surgery to cut it, drain it and stitch it up. I then had blood transfusions and a catheter fitted. I was then stitched front to back. The pain was still horrendous. I was told something about an internal tear being missed, but I wasn't sure of the ins and outs. I just knew that I would be staying in hospital for the next few days to recover. Most of my friends visited over those days, even my old best friend Hannah, which really surprised me. Hannah and I went to school together, but we weren't particularly close then. She was in the year above me and she was stunning, the most popular girl in school who everyone wanted to know. We had also worked together at the dental surgery for a while and became inseparable. I also loved Hannah's mum, Helen, a woman who worked so hard. She had a beautiful little home and she lived for our children. There was another reason I loved Hannah. She had an older brother called Josh who was just as gorgeous as her. He was quiet and shy, but he made my heart beat faster every time I saw him because of how ridiculously beautiful he was. When I first became a dental nurse, I was really close to Hannah, and during the week we would stay at her house. She lived there with her mum and her brother. Her dad had passed away the previous year, and it was clear that all three of them were trying to live with a broken heart. Helen invited me into their family immediately, and she would make me dinner every night and breakfast before we left for work in the mornings. She doted on our children despite losing her husband, her soulmate, in such a cruel way. At the weekends, we would stay at my house in Torquay. This was where the clubs were, and we would spend the weekend going out together. We were never apart. When I got together with Tony, Hannah was livid. She was really angry that he was so much older than me. She was aware of his reputation, and she saw the massive change in me from being a partying hard, fun, outgoing girl to a stepmother of three young children who never left the house other than to go to work. She grew tired of arguing with me about me leaving him, but eventually accepted my choice, and things did stay amicable. Hannah came to the hospital to meet Betsy, but I knew that she, like all my other visitors, felt the visits were tinged with sadness at what I had become and the life that I was leading. Unsurprisingly, I suffered with postnatal depression immediately. I arrived home from hospital and my dog excitedly jumped on the bed to greet me, but there was a feeling to being back that I just couldn't shift. Mum had arrived down to see me from Lincolnshire and would be staying for a few weeks to settle me in. I was so glad of that, but there was a downside too. My mum is an amazing sorter. She can tidy up and potter around for hours to make any house into a home. She enjoys ironing and cleaning and she loves to look after people. Anyway, she started shouting at the dog. He couldn't be near Betsy because he was full of germs. He would lick her face, or worse still, if he landed on her with his weight and size, he would kill her. I knew that Mum was only trying to protect everyone. She was trying to help, and part of what she was saying was right, but the anger that brewed inside me wasn't normal. He was my fucking dog. He was the only one that had loved me all day every day, even when I was a shit owner who hadn't walked him, even when he'd been to the vets and had an injection. He always loved me, and if he wanted to jump on the bed to meet Betsy, then he should have been allowed to jump on the fucking bed. But instead I didn't shout back. I didn't react. I just cried silent tears on my own in the bedroom that no one saw. The feeling of unhappiness, desperation, loneliness, and an awful empty feeling consumed me. To this day, I cannot explain it. I just felt so, so sad all of the time. Sad and angry, raging and desperate, and I could never explain why, all while trying to put on a brave face. I felt I was the only mum in the world who struggled. I felt I was the only one that had these dark thoughts. I felt a shitload of guilt at having them and not being like everyone else who seemed to thrive on motherhood, who seemed to cope, who seemed to enjoy getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to feed a baby or change a nappy. So I hid my feelings. I pretended I was just like them and I was enjoying every minute of motherhood. Breastfeeding almost killed me. On reflection, I think it was so hard because there isn't enough awareness about how much it fucking hurts. It is a pain like no other. Like other women, I was used to having my breasts touched, and I would often check them for lumps, but having them sucked and grabbed all day, every day is not something my breasts are used to coping with. If someone had warned me about the sheer agony that I was about to endure, I would have coped far better. Yes, I probably would have still sat on the edge of the bed with a pillow in my mouth to bite when she latched on. I probably still would have begged and pleaded with every member of my family to go to Boots and buy me tubs of formula, because that tiny mouth of hers clamped round my nipple was causing me more pain than she ever did when she came out of me. But I would have been prepared. Now, I warn women everywhere. Any pregnant woman or new mum who is breastfeeding, I tell them the truth. It fucking wrecks. No one ever tells you, but believe me, it is like shattered glass slicing into your nipples. Until your boobs get to grips with the change that they are now udders to keep a tiny human alive, it will be hell. Get shares in Lansinol, smother it on even if you think you don't need to, and have a pillow ready to bite down on when they latch on. 2 weeks, give it 2 weeks, and after that it will be like a walk in the park, I promise. People have thanked me for that advice, because without it they say that they would have given up. And I always said it needs highlighting more. A book on The Pain of Breastfeeding should probably be my next one. If you don't want to go through the pain, or you find it's all just too much, then bottle feed. Who cares? Your body has now gone to absolute ruin thanks to this tiny bundle of joy, so as long as you're keeping it alive with milk, I truly believe it doesn't matter which sort. In spite of my mum's advice, the dog loved Betsy, as did her three elder sisters who helped me bathe her, put her to bed, and help wind her after I fed her. What was getting worse right now was my relationship with Tony. He still ran the pubs, which meant he would be gone by 9 o'clock every morning to take a delivery. He would then pop home for a few hours in the afternoon, but because he was tired, he would sleep, or lie around irritating me whilst watching TV. He would then go back to work and return anywhere between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning. We still lived above the pub at this time, and he'd come up with the genius plan of having topless barmaids to make the business boom. The CCTV was rigged up to our flat upstairs, so that he could keep an eye on things when he wasn't in the pub. But all those 12 cameras did was fuel my paranoia and make me sink deeper into depression, watching him cavort with young, petite, beautiful, half-naked girls behind a bar with their pert tits out on display. I remember Christmas Eve 2004 so very clearly. Betsy was 4 months old, and I had my 3 stepdaughters overnight. Tony was working downstairs, the pub was heaving, and the barmaids were, again, topless. I watched him chatting to 2 young blonde girls. He then walked over to the bar with them, and he clicked his finger to the barmaid to get drinks for them all. They continued to chat and laugh, and as he handed them their free drinks, he slowly pushed their heads together so they began kissing each other. He then put his head in between them, and I saw all 3 of them tonguing and caressing each other. I thought I was going to vomit. I was like a maniac, sat there, breastfeeding my baby in the dark, while studying the CCTV of my partner full-on tonguing 2 other women, while his 3 other daughters were sleeping in the room next to me. I settled Betsy into her Moses basket and I started running down the stairs towards the pub. I had fake tan that night to make myself feel a bit better for Christmas Day. The only fake tan back then was Saint-Tropez, which needed to be left on for 12 hours. When you applied it, there was a green tinge all over that made you look like you were starting to rot. It also smelled rancid. So here I was, a bright green psychopath, sporting a headband to keep the greasy locks off my face, whilst dressed in a milk-stained dressing gown, sprinting down the stairs ready to lose my mind. But as I got to the bottom step, he opened the front door. The row that took place that night was one of the worst. It was extremely violent, whilst 4 babies slept above us waiting for Santa to come. Christmas Day was horrific. I was battered and bruised whilst pretending to my family that everything was fine. It was a mask that I got used to wearing. When I pack this part of my life into a chapter like this, it does seem that an unbearable amount happened. Gaining a family, being thrust into being a new mum to an unplanned baby, dealing with mental health issues and domestic violence. But even during this time, when I was a desperately unhappy shell of a person, there were still rays of light. There were still times I was happy and grateful for the things that I had. I found out who my true friends were, and my amazing daughter came into my life. I chose to cover the breastfeeding because for me, and for so many other women I now speak to, it's the one bad memory that's always remained with us. The debate between breast and bottle is out there so much, and that debate can be fierce, but I refuse to participate in it. Many amazing adults were fed formula and they turned out just fine. Do what you need to do to keep well, because ultimately, If you are killing yourself to please society, your baby isn't getting the best from its mama. My postnatal depression stands out here, but so does the domestic abuse, and these two together are a killer, mainly because so many women I now work with have been left paralysed with fear that they will have their children taken away if they leave their abusive relationship while they're still struggling with postnatal depression. It's a favourite for perpetrators to tell their partners, and one that I hear daily. It's also bullshit. You don't lose your baby because you're unwell. You will be given tools and support to help you cope, I promise. And if you have a friend who is in an abusive relationship, just be there for her. Supporting someone suffering from domestic abuse is at times one of the most frustrating things to do. You might not understand why she doesn't just leave, but if you read up on the cycle of abuse, you might. It's not as easy as just packing up your bags and heading out. Be patient, please be patient, because she needs you. She needs friends and she needs not to be judged. There will hopefully come a time where she decides to go, and that's when you can swing into action. But until then, just support. Just let her know that you care about her without making her feel shit about something else that she hasn't managed to do. Chapter 6. Brokenhearted. There were other changes in my life too, not just Betsy. Tony encouraged me to have a relationship with my dad, because he hadn't known his real father and he hated his stepdad, so he used to play the "what if he died" card, which made me feel like a shit daughter. It was something else to be added to the list of how crap I was. I saw my dad away from his house for the first few years, away from my stepmom. He would come and cook for me on a Saturday afternoon, as that was one of the things that he loved to do. My favourite meal is liver and onions, but I cannot for the life of me cook it. Every week he would show me how to roll the liver in flour and then fry it with onions, and he would make the tastiest gravy. So I looked forward to him coming over, and I suppose looking after me, like a father should look after his child. And he did it so well. He was also amazing with the four girls, and he would tell them stories about what he got up to when he was young. He would play games like chopping off his thumb or putting his fingers through flames of fire, and they would watch in amazement, and he would make us all laugh until we cried, because when he is happy, my dad is one of the funniest, kindest men I have ever been around. I was in my early 20s by this point, and it was the first time I really felt like I knew my father. He still worked hard and far away from home. Pam didn't seem particularly close to her own family, and as much as I never wanted to feel happy at someone's sadness, I did. I believed that she had had her karma, sat in a huge, once beautiful home, all alone. I started going to the house with Tony and the children, just for an hour on weekends at the start. Pam was there, and as far as I was concerned, she hadn't changed. It seemed clear to me that we shouldn't make ourselves at home, whereas her grandchildren from her biological children had their own bedrooms in that house, full of toys that our children felt they couldn't touch. I knew I would always try to make no difference between Betsy and Tony's girls. As long as we were together, I've always believed that our children shouldn't pay the price for the behaviour of adults. I don't know if Dad saw how she was and chose to ignore it, or whether he just wanted a quiet life and chose to pretend it wasn't happening, but I believe that he knew. He wasn't stupid, and the way he acted when she was around was totally different to how he was when she wasn't there. I had the same feeling of anxiety in my stomach when I was around her, and now it seemed that it was there for my girls too. I couldn't bear for them to ask her for anything. Children that are raised with love are naturally curious. They will touch things. They'll say that they want to drink, moan that they're hungry. They want to explore. But being there filled me with the same sick, anxious feeling that I'd grown up with. I tried to see Dad as often as possible away from his house, and I always made out to him that I was lucky to have met Tony and that I was happy. He knew how much I loved Tony's girls, and I think I always wanted to prove to him that I did okay on my own, without him. I think deep down he was really proud of me, and I think he believed that I was happy. By this time, I was still working for the same company, but I'd moved up the ladder, and I held a demanding position within the senior management team. I had a new company car, and I earned a good wage. My house was a home. I cooked and cleaned, and I knew that all of this made Dad proud. He always secretly gave me money. He would shove a wad of notes into my pockets and say, "It's between us." I always protested, even though most of the time I was drowning in debt, but he wouldn't take no for an answer. I think it was guilt money, actually. Guilt because he had let me down massively, and he would never really be able to make it up to me like he should. I felt like I had a dad, though, and my girls had a granddad, Although he had no idea how unhappy, trapped and desperate I was, I knew that if I needed him, he was there at the end of the phone. By now we spoke every morning when I drove to work, and most evenings he would call me from his van. He still worked away, and despite getting an allowance to stay overnight in hotels, he had a mattress in the back of his van where he slept. He would share in the services where the lorries parked, and he would go into a supermarket late at night to get reduced food. He would make me laugh until I cried by telling me that he had bought a roast chicken for a quid and some out-of-date rolls which he would use all week for breakfast, lunch and dinner. It felt good to have him back. Until one day, Pam announced that they were getting married. I couldn't believe it. After all these years, how could he do what we believed he would never do? How could he marry this woman? I left for work on the Monday morning after I found out, and my heartache turned to rage. I had a shit day and I got home late. I put the girls to bed, then Tony and I began fighting. I can't remember what it was over, but it escalated quickly and he lost his temper. He knew that he'd gone too far, so as he left for his evening shift at work, he locked the front door behind him so I couldn't escape. The back door was open, but we had built the gate up to over 6 foot outside, and it was kept locked and strengthened because our dog was amazing at absconding. I was now trapped in the house, but it was a regular thing and it didn't bother me. Half an hour later the doorbell rang. I opened the letterbox and it was my dad. I told him that Tony had accidentally taken the key to work so I couldn't let him in. I knew he thought I was lying, so I told him to climb over the gate if he wanted to come in, and he did. The sight was so funny, and as shit as the situation was, it still makes me giggle to this day. An overweight, 50-year-old man with a massive ginger hair scaling a 6-foot gate while muttering swear words, attempting to break into his daughter's house to speak to her. By the time he walked into the lounge, he was seething. "What's going on?" he demanded. I wanted to let my rage out, so I don't think I left a thing out of what it was like to be at home for me and my siblings whilst he was away grafting to give us a better life whilst we were growing up. I was bordering on a panic attack as I spoke, but I managed to remain controlled. I took deep breaths so that my chokes didn't turn into panic breaths, and I started again whenever I needed to. He stood and he listened for what seemed like forever. I told him everything, well, everything that I could, because I now know that I've blocked out many things along the way due to the horrific feelings that I had. I felt that he believed me. He stood up, and as he was leaving, he said, "I'm going to see your brothers and sister. If they tell me what you have, then I'll leave her, but I'll also not see you again, because if I allowed these things to happen, I don't deserve to be your dad." As I watched him leave, I knew then that I'd lost him either way. He did go and see my brothers and my sister, and they tell me that they repeated my stories along with their own. But then he went home and he married her. The sad truth is, I haven't ever seen or heard from him since that day 9 years ago when he scaled my back gate. I cannot comprehend as a parent how you just write your children off. I still go through stages where I question why my parents had 4 children. At times, I feel so angry that they had both been selfish enough to produce us, yet neither of them were ever committed enough to raise us for our whole lives or to love and protect us. I try to let all the hurt, anger and hatred for him, my mum and Pam go, or it would eat me up. I have spent too much money on therapy sessions where I have cried over a broken childhood. Therapy sessions where I spent an hour just sobbing into a tissue while my amazing therapist explained and broke down what I was going through. How the people in charge of raising me as a child had failed me so badly. Now, when anyone says to me, "When your parents die, it will all be too late," or "What I'd give to have my mum and dad alive again," I think about how it already is too late. You don't stop being a parent when your child becomes an adult. I have needed my parents more in adulthood than I ever did when I was a child. I am still their child, and there should be something inside of them that makes them want to die for me, kill for me, and love and protect me until the day they die. But it just isn't there. That switch that sits inside you when you become a parent never turned on for either of them. So I'm done. I'm a fatherless daughter, but I'm absolutely at peace with that. And if anything, it makes me want what's right for my own children even more. Chapter 7. Babies and Bin Bags. However, there were more things I needed to do in my life to try and reach some kind of peace, and another major problem was my relationship with Tony. So in May 2005, we split up. It was a Friday morning and we'd had a huge row because I'd asked for permission to go to the Run to the Sun festival in Cornwall with some friends. He told me I wasn't going, but I hadn't left the house other than to go to work since Betsy had been born 9 months earlier, and I just wanted one night to be me with my old girlfriends, to get drunk, laugh and have no responsibility. The argument started as I was putting Betsy's clean washing away in her wardrobe and she sat on the rug not far away from me. I'm going, I told Tony. Watch what happens if you tell me that you're going again. I knew exactly what would happen, but that feeling I had of being controlled was so unjust, it was so unfair, and at the age of 23, I was having to ask my partner to have my first night out in almost a year, and it was being refused, so I repeated the words to him, I'm going. The violence that rained down on me that day was horrific. All while my baby continued to sit nearby, sucking on her teething toys and babbling away to herself. As soon as he left for work that night, I got Betsy and my things together, then my brother John picked us up. I called the Women's Refuge in Exeter, and they told me they had a room for us. John dropped me at Exeter train station, where I was met by a lady in a car who drove us to the safe house nearby. I was pumped full of adrenaline, fear, and genuine sadness at what was happening. I arrived at the refuge and I felt so unwell. I kept being sick and I couldn't eat. I blamed it all on my anxiety and depression, but one of the ladies with me just kept looking at me as if she was thinking something through. How exactly do you feel? She kept asking, but it was hard to answer as the vomiting just wouldn't stop. Finally, she left me with my head in the sink, but came back about 15 minutes later. She'd gone out to buy me a pregnancy test. She was right, I was pregnant again. When I saw the two blue lines appear, I genuinely thought my only option would be to kill myself. I was in such a bad place. A few days later, I went to the GP who referred me to the hospital and they confirmed that I was about 6 weeks pregnant. I felt absolutely devastated. I would spend ages in the refuge just watching Betsy, knowing that I was carrying her sibling but facing the realisation that I just wasn't coping. I now weighed under 6.5 stone and I looked skeletal. I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't see how I would manage with another baby. I spoke to my friends and family, who all told me I would be mad to keep going with this pregnancy. In their eyes, my relationship with Tony was over, and they were desperate to keep me away from him, so I booked a termination for the following Saturday. On the day of the termination, I went to Torbay Hospital with my sister. We were sat in the waiting room, and I was shaken with the emotion of it all. I did feel guilty, but I also knew that there was no way I could justify bringing another baby into this mess. I still couldn't forget that Betsy was used to it now, as were her three older sisters. The four girls now didn't flinch when they heard screams and shouts, and they continued to play alongside the violence that they witnessed. All of a sudden, Tony burst into the hospital screaming. He was shouting that I was a baby murderer and that I deserved to die. The whole waiting room just looked at me and him in total disbelief. No one tried to stop him, and he continued to rant and rave. Eventually, security arrived and he was removed, but by now I was a mess. I was crying so hard that I wasn't actually crying, if that makes sense. It was one of those cries children make where they've really hurt themselves, the cry where there is no noise, just tears. This continued until the anaesthetist told me he was unhappy to continue. I had to make this happen, though. I knew in my head I had to go through with the termination, so I begged them to carry on, saying I was just upset with myself for getting into this situation. Eventually, they agreed. But after the operation, I was broken. I had never felt guilt like it. Last year, I told Betsy the truth. I felt I had no option but to do this because her relationship with her dad had become so volatile. So I sat her down and I explained to her my reasons and the situation. She took my face in her hands, kissed my forehead and said, I love you, Mum. Don't ever think that you have to explain yourself to me. After a few weeks of anger after the termination, Tony started begging me to go back to him. He said he was sorry, that he had changed, things would be different. He promised to leave the pub trade and get a normal job, which meant we could be a family. I desperately missed my stepdaughters and I was carrying hideous guilt over the termination. So I went back. We had agreed to try one more time, moving house yet again, to give us another fresh start. I left the refuge pretending I wasn't going home, but it was obvious to everyone there what was happening. I guess they'd seen it all before. The women I met in there were amazing. We all swapped numbers and promised to stay in touch. One of them was from Birmingham. It was her 17th time in refuge, and she had 3 babies to her partner. She was black and blue all over. She had been stabbed in the past, beaten with weapons, and repeatedly raped. I remember her oldest sons spitting at her and attacking her when they had tantrums. It was just devastating to watch. They had learned from the behaviour around them. 6 months after I left refuge, I saw her in Primark in Torquay with her children and partner. We both looked away like we didn't know each other, to keep her safe. The image has always stayed with me, and I often wonder if she ever got away for good, or if she's still there, or if she became a suicide statistic. I met an elderly lady in the refuge too, a woman in her 60s who was wheelchair-bound due to ill health. Her husband beat her every few months, so she came to refuge, for respite, as she called it, until he calmed down. She didn't even see that he was in the wrong, she just thought they needed a bit of time apart every so often. She was unable to conceive children when they were younger, and due to her illness, she needed him to care for her, so she took the entire blame for his violence. It was heartbreaking. We never stayed in touch. There's something sad about that. After you spend so much time sharing stories and helping raise each other's children, you leave the refuge and you never knew who returned to their partners, who became free, or whether any of them became another number on a coroner's report. Upon returning home, things seemed better for a while, but I know now that this is part of the cycle. This was what is called the honeymoon period. We moved away from the pub, and Tony was now home in the evenings and around more at weekends. Soon, though, we began to argue. Sometimes I didn't fight back, and I would try my hardest to be a good wife and mum, but it was draining. Other times I would cause the fights, I admit that. I was so trapped and unhappy that I would pick a fight knowing it would end with violence, just because I wanted unhappiness for us both rather than me alone. It was horrific, volatile and abusive and poisonous, but it was normal. Normal for me and normal for us, a continuing cycle that just went round and round and round for the next 3 years. A year later, and after more temporary splits, I became pregnant again. I can't remember whether I was happy or sad, or if the pregnancy was a mistake. I don't know why I don't remember such huge things, yet I still remember silly small things, like listening to Pink's album on repeat when I was driving to work, or the little sport button on my car that made it go faster on my 2004 Edge baby blue Fiat Punto. I wanted to find out the gender of the baby, which we hadn't done with Betsy. Tony said no, but I begged and begged until he agreed. We went to the hospital with his mum, and upon having the scan, the sonographer told us we were having another little girl. Tony flew into a rage. He started swearing and then he stormed out of the scanning room. The sonographer asked if I was okay. If you hadn't have found out the sex, he would have been fine, Tony's mum had said. When the baby was born a girl, he would have loved her as soon as he laid eyes on her, but you can't love a scan picture. What is he supposed to do? He'll have to go another 4 months knowing he isn't getting the boy that he's desperate for. All my fault, again. I think the sonographer was in shock. It seems surreal looking back on that whole scenario now, but I can picture it all. Me thinking I had done something wrong, and rather than being happy that I had a healthy baby girl inside me, I chased Tony through the hospital wards, begging for forgiveness for conceiving a girl and promising him that it would all be okay. This labour started with the same swelling that I'd had with Betsy. I was admitted to hospital and I was induced. I kid you not, the contraction started within half an hour. I was on the level below the labour ward with my mum, sister and Tony. The midwives kept telling me I wasn't having contractions, that what I was feeling was pain from the inducing pill. I could tell they thought I was being dramatic, so they refused me any pain relief, so I made Tony go to Boots and buy a TENS machine. The pain quickly became unbearable and my sister went to get the nurses. As I was in a ward that wasn't for labouring women, there were families visiting new mums and other pregnant women with issues, but no one was in labour, except me. It was busy, and by now I was writhing round the bed, throwing back the sheets while screaming, "It's coming!" My mum went into full-blown panic as she saw the head, and all of a sudden loads of midwives appeared and ran with my bed up to the labour ward, only I didn't make it that far. The baby arrived in the lift after about 18 minutes, after a few goes on the gas and air. Tony returned from Boots clutching a TENS machine just in time to meet his fifth daughter. Mum chose her name, Tallulah Bell. She was 7 pounds, 10 ounces, and another perfect bundle of joy that I'd loved as much as I loved her sister. I had no complications and I went home the following day. I don't remember suffering with postnatal depression with Tallulah, but then I don't remember much from any of that time, which makes me feel really shit. I went back to work 6 weeks later, and Tony's mum raised all five girls while Tony and I were pretty much absent. Tony's mum was an amazing